Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for taking the time and the effort to download the latest episode from Peter B. Collins. I'm your humble host, and I want to thank the people who subscribe to this program, including Michael Powell, David Radcliffe, Susan Super, and Andy Drawl, transplanted to the left coast now. Coming up before the end of this podcast, Gary Chu has a film review of the new movie about bullying. And what you're about to hear was a live broadcast yesterday, Wednesday, April 18th, as I was invited to sit in for my friend and colleague Brad Friedman of bradblog.com. He has a weekly show on KPFK in Los Angeles, and we used our high-tech gizmos to plug in from here in San Francisco and spent an hour on the radio, got some interesting callers, and you're about to hear John Stauber from Madison, Wisconsin, a longtime anti-corporate activist, talk about the murky group called ALEC and its impact on state legislation. And you're also going to hear Scott Crow, the anarchist who's been a guest on our program before. Thanks for listening today.
Later this hour, I want you to meet Scott Crow. He is a self-described anarchist, and he's based in Austin, Texas. He also spent time in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where he was one of the founders of the Common Ground Collective. And I find Scott Crow to be a fascinating guy, and he brings, I think, depth and humanity to the term anarchist. So I think you'll enjoy hearing from him a little bit later in the hour. Also, as usual, we will bring you the Brad Blog Green News Report with Brad and Desi. That's coming up about half an hour from now. And all that is available here on KPFK during the next hour. You're invited to call in and join the conversation, and I welcome your calls and comments. The number here is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. John Stauber joins me now. He says he's retired, but he is one of the longest-serving corporate or anti-corporate activists in this country. He's a founder of the Madison, Wisconsin-based Center for Media and Democracy. He's written or co-authored a number of books about toxic sludge, about the spin that corporations put on PR, and a number of other subjects. John, thanks for joining me today here on KPFK.
Peter, it's great to be on with you, and folks in Los Angeles are in for a treat, able to hear Peter B. Collins on the air there.
Oh, you're very kind. The check's in the mail, John.
All right, I'll cash it.
Well, I did a little research on the preceding programs that Brad has done here on the Bradcast, and I think we can assume that KPFK listeners are not strangers to the term ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And at the Center for Media and Democracy, your colleagues, I know you're retired from there, but they're still your colleagues, have been doing an incredible job of informing Americans about this murky group and the work that surfaces in legislation at various states around the country. And in some ways, Wisconsin has been ground zero for the work of ALEC, because you have been under siege for more than a year now, and some of the boilerplate legislation that your Governor Scott Walker and his Republican allies in the legislature have used were written by ALEC. So just in case there's somebody who doesn't know about ALEC, give us a 30-second summary of this group, John Stauber.
Well, when you say ALEC, A-L-E-C, That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. And I would encourage people to Google ALEC, A-L-E-C, and they will see the national firestorm that my old organization, the Center for Media and Democracy, has lit under this corporate-funded, Koch brother-funded, right-wing organization that until about a year ago was very invisible. But once our governor here in Wisconsin, Scott Walker, decided to destroy the state union collective bargaining agreements, the role of ALEC in right-wing legislation of that sort became front and center. And then a little less than a year ago, a whistleblower leaked to Lisa Graves at the Center for Media and Democracy a ton of internal documents that the center put up online. And it turns out ALEC for decades has been extremely involved in directly facilitating corporations working with state legislators to pass a right-wing agenda, as they like to call it, a free market agenda. This issue of ALEC's role really hit a new level of awareness with the death of Trayvon Martin in Florida
right.
a couple of months ago, because Trayvon Martin was shot by a gentleman who's now charged with second-degree murder, who in his defense is going to use a stand-your-ground law, which is something ALEC has championed and helped put on the books all over the country, which essentially allows a shooter to pull a trigger if the shooter feels threatened by somebody who is refusing to stand still. So it's very exciting that the center has been able to expose ALEC, and your listeners, if they Google ALEC, and will find lots of articles. And if you Google ALEC and California, I'm sure you'll find articles on the role of ALEC in passing right-wing pro-business legislation in the state of California, too.
Well, and I want to invite listeners to go to prwatch.org. That is the powerful website of the Center for Media and Democracy. And there's quite a bit. We'll talk about some of it with John here in the course of the next few minutes. But a little bit of history first, John, because this is another example of the way the hard right and corporate interests in this country work what the Grifters movie would call the long con. And Paul Weyrich is one of the people. He's a far-right, pro-life guy who's been active since the Nixon era. And he is one of the people who put ALEC together. So this stands in contrast to many liberal, progressive, and even moderate groups that don't really have 20-year plans. But what we're seeing surface from ALEC in the past year, in the union-busting efforts in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and elsewhere, and in the stand-your-ground legislation, these are just some of the examples. There are many more. But this is part of the long-term effort by the right wing in this country to prevail on almost every front.
Exactly. And Paul Weyrich is called by many people the founder of the right-wing revolution that emerged in the 1980s and put former California Governor Ronald Reagan into office, and has been the dominant political force in the country for the last 30 years. So ALEC, again, has been doing damage for an awfully long time. And it's a great example, too, unfortunately, of the failure of mainstream media to take a look at the role of organizations like ALEC and the way that behind the scenes in state legislatures, corporations, and especially these far-right corporate agendas, of the food industry, the gun industry, are really creating laws and putting them on the books.
Well, and the media role here is significant, and I'm glad you raised that, because I'm one of those people who follows the corporate media and tries to criticize it to people through my podcast and through radio broadcasts who probably don't watch, for example, the PBS NewsHour. But I am pretty faithful. I watch it 4 or 5 nights a week, and I watch it critically. And it was really interesting to see, despite the incredible controversy and excessive coverage of the Trayvon Martin case, that the PBS NewsHour only a week ago first brought to its viewers the role of Alec, and they did it in passing in a backhanded way that really didn't emphasize the way it works and how influential Alec has been on state legislatures across the country. And likewise, the New York Times has been extremely lame in addressing the connection between Alec and the right-wing gains that we have seen in the class war of the past year.
Right. I would say in the case of the New York Times, their most influential piece was an editorial column by Paul Krugman that made the link between Alec, Stand Your Ground, and Trayvon Martin. You know, it's interesting, Peter, because we're very aware, you and I are, and more and more people in the country are, thanks to Center for Media and Democracy and the whistleblower who provided all the documents, of the role of Alec. But I think it's worth pointing out that corporations have funded similar organizations for many decades that have also written laws at the state level and put them on the books. There are other organizations like the Council of State Governments, the National Conference of State Legislatures, the State Legislative Leaders Foundation, the National Governors Association, through which corporations have very intimate relations with politicians and are able to, behind the scenes, put into law a state legislation that favors their interests. What makes Alec so unique and so important is that Alec is truly, as you pointed out, the creation of the far right, and it pushes a very extreme far right agenda, and it's pushed it with ease and no real criticism outside of groups like Center for Media and Democracy until sort of the perfect storm of the release of documents, the right-wing attack on workers here in Wisconsin and other states, and now the tragic death of a black man in Florida whose alleged killer or admitted killer is going to use the defense of, well, he didn't stand his ground, I had to shoot him.
Yeah. We're talking with John Stauber. He is retired, but he founded or co-founded the Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. He's with us till the bottom of the hour. So if you have a question or comment, feel free to join us. The call-in number here at KPFK is 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Brad Friedman today here on the Bradcast. And, John, let's talk a little bit about how Alec works, and in particular, if legislators who have taken free trips on so-called scholarships to Alec conferences held at plush resorts, if they have violated state regulations or ethics rules regarding the acceptance of bribes in exchange for introducing legislation. Because there's a very clear nexus here of legislators who have been wined and dined by Alec, who go to their conferences, they get briefed on a law like Stand Your Ground, and then they go back to their state house and introduce that, often without any attribution to Alec whatsoever.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the most important test here is the smell test. You just described the process very accurately. It's behind closed doors. It involves freebie trips to glamorous places. It involves sitting down with corporations and their lobbyists, who, of course, are also campaign donors, and crafting legislation to their liking, and then coming back and introducing it in the state legislature with absolutely no revelation of how this came about, and that very intimate and possibly illegal, depending on the strength of state ethics laws, process that resulted in this legislation going on the books. And, of course, one thing that's happened, I really see this in Wisconsin, being a lifelong resident of Wisconsin. I've observed this over the last 40 years. One thing that's happened in state capitals is that the decimation of mainstream journalism has meant that there are many fewer reporters paying any attention at all, doing any sort of critical analysis of what goes on in state legislatures. You know, in Madison, Wisconsin, Wisconsin's a small state, I think about 5 or 6 million people. Back 40 years ago, if you walked into the state capitol and you went to the press room, you would have walked into a room in which there were probably 25 working members of the news media, radio, TV, print media, a couple of newspapers in Milwaukee, now there's only one, a couple of newspapers in Madison, now there's only one. The Associated Press alone have three full-time reporters. You walk into that press room today, there's nobody there. State governments are getting away with creating legislation simply to the liking of lobbyists and organizations like ALEC, in part because journalism has been decimated. And when I look at where those journalists are, by the way, it's amazing how many of them are now working in various public relations, PR, propaganda jobs, often for the corporations they used to try to expose in journalistic fashion.
Well, John, and your point's well taken. It's replicated in California as well. In Sacramento, 30 years ago, when we had a governor named Jerry Brown, almost anything he did, like take a trip to Africa with Linda Ronstadt, was covered like flies on a piece of fruit. But now,
especially taking a trip to Africa with Linda Ronstadt.
but now, Jerry Brown would have to threaten to kill his dog to get enough reporters to come and talk to him about the state budget crisis or the refusal of Republicans to consider raising taxes to cover our deficit. And all of these are there's a coordinated strategy by the Republicans to obstruct, and their corporate benefactors who run these large corporate media outlets have made cuts in coverage that, serve their interests. They don't feel the public needs to know as much about the budget battle in Sacramento or Madison because Kim Kardashian is considering running for mayor of a community near Los Angeles. I mean, come on!
Well, again, I'm here in Wisconsin, and folks in California are going to be seeing a lot more coverage out of Madison, Wisconsin, as this recall election shapes up. There are four Democratic candidates, and I think there will probably be one or two Greens running in a primary next month. And then in June, there's going to be a race between our anti-union, ALEC-loving governor, Scott Walker.
Who takes calls from Koch brothers and Koch brother imitators.
and one of these Democrats. And I have to tell you, Peter, it's going to be extremely close. The Wisconsin Uprising did an incredible job in collecting almost a million copies, a million signatures, rather, on petitions to force this recall. And remember, this is a state with about 6 million people. This is not California. And they did it in 60 days. It was tremendous. But the Walker right-wing agenda does have a lot of support in the state. Wisconsin is one of those states a little bit like Kansas. What's the matter with Kansas?
Right.
It's a state that can go either Democrat or Republican. And this is going to be a watershed election, and it's going to really have a national impact. If Scott Walker manages to defeat the recall movement, it's going to give a big boost to the ALEC right-wing agenda nationwide.
You know what your recall needs? We had one a few years ago here in California. There were 130 people who ran against Gray Davis. And we'd be happy to loan you Arianna Huffington, Rodney Coleman, Gary Coleman, I'm sorry. Or there was even a sex film star who ran. And we'd be happy to loan them to Wisconsin, maybe for a draft pick from the Packers?
Yeah, your process out there is a little different. Wasn't that the election to put Arnold Schwarzenegger in office?
Yes, that's true.
Okay, here's a trivia question for you. Where did Arnold Schwarzenegger go to college?
Oh, I don't remember. So you've stumped me, John.
University of Wisconsin Superior.
I didn't know that.
No one knows that.
Well, that's back in his pot-smoking days. I've got a couple of callers for you here, John. Let's talk first to Ken from Pine Grove. Hello, Ken. You're on KPFK on the broadcast with Peter B. Collins and John Stauber.
How you doing?
Doing fine. Glad you called.
Yeah. So these Stand Your Ground laws, of course, have been sold on the idea of grandma, you know, hiding in her bedroom, having to shoot the assailant as they inevitably approach her, which is fine because some of these cases where grandma did that, she wound up being run through the rigmarole and going to jail and all kinds of stuff. But there needs to be some kind of outrage on the sense of the judge that these laws are being misapplied. They either need to get outraged during the statement of defense or during the sentencing phase if the person is found guilty.
Well, in fact, we just learned today we're going to get a new judge in Sanford, Florida, because the woman it was assigned to has a relative who, I guess, referred George Zimmerman to his attorney. So Nancy Grace is going to have a field day with this. And frankly, I'm content to wait until a jury reviews the evidence and reaches its judgment. For me, this is another case that is being tried by television, and it empowers anybody with a remote control to act like they are judge and jury. And I don't know if you happen to see the Frontline broadcast on PBS last night, but they took apart the forensic evidence that has been used to falsely convict people. They showed how the Casey Anthony trial, the one that moved Nancy Grace to a scream fest and her makeup got all screwed up, because the jury didn't return the verdict that she had authorized or you know, reached in advance. And so there are real issues here where we've got to let the judicial system do its job and not have television cameras and well-coiffed anchors really driving a kind of hysteria and vigilante sense of justice.
Exactly.
John, do you want to make a comment?
No, I think you both made excellent points.
Thank you, Ken. Now to Gigi from Pasadena. Hello, Gigi. You're on KPFK. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a question. I'm trying to wrap my mind around the Stand Your Ground law.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my understanding is if someone approaches you, I don't think, unless I'm wrong, would that apply to someone that's actually stalking someone? Because it seems to me, we could all go out and you know, with a gun and stalk someone that we just think looks wrong and whatever that means. And then when they have the audacity to turn around and try to defend themselves because they see me coming at them with a gun, I get to blow them away and say, well, they were coming at me. This sounds like Wild Wild West mentality. It reminds me of the irony of, like, the Haitians. When they wouldn't allow themselves to be enslaved, they then got, they said, okay, well, then you owe us all this money because you won't let us make slaves do. I get the same feeling. I'm going to take my answer off the air.
All right, Gigi, I appreciate that. John, what's your comment here on the Stand Your Ground law?
I think most of us never even knew these laws existed until the tragedy of Trayvon Martin's death.
Mm-hmm.
And when you first hear this, it's stunning. I mean, we all know we live in a country that worships the right to own and firearms and protects the right to use firearms in self-defense. It's a constitutional issue, and the National Rifle Association is one of the strongest lobbies in the United States. But the idea that there's now additional legislation at the state level that allows a person to shoot somebody because they didn't stand their ground is just stunning. And I like your response earlier, Peter. I'm hoping that the TV attention that this trial will get will really raise this question of these laws that Alec has helped put on the books across the nation, and that are laws, of course, welcomed by the National Rifle Association and the gun lobby.
And John, I don't have any real hope that the media will be restrained. They get ratings by exploiting the racial tensions that are very clearly at play in this case. But they don't report on the racism that clearly is at least one element of the Stand Your Ground law and its application in Florida. As a kid, I spent some time living in Florida. And the deep racism there and the segregation remains to this day. And the redneck justice system run by white people clearly treats African Americans in ways that don't rise to fundamental standards of human rights and justice. And yet we don't see that part of it probed. We're not seeing reports about the elements of racism that are alive and well in Florida today. We instead get the back and forth, and the most extreme voices are the ones that are played the loudest.
Right, and I would say that the fact that it took weeks and weeks for charges to be brought in this case, and that there was a major question of whether charges would even be brought, is an indictment of the culture of racism that exists all across the U.S., certainly in this area of Florida.
Yeah. John, let's take one more caller before we run out of time here. Matt from Topanga, welcome to KPFK, and thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. Actually about Kim Kardashian, her rotund derriere has actually been it's its own district, and so she's the mayor of that.
Matt, I need somebody to help me understand the whole Kardashian phenomenon, because I don't get who they are or why in the hell anybody cares.
Oh,
yeah, Peter, that's why you're on KPFK.
I guess so.
I didn't get that memo either.
What's on your mind, Matt?
Alec is very frightening. It is one of these perfect classical definitions of Mussolini's definition of fascism. And, there's so many truths that are subverted. The old Orwell quote, in times of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. And it's more and more, find it more and more difficult to actually steer people towards the truth. And I'm always open to people's different techniques, because, if somebody senses your contempt, they don't want to listen to you. But it's hard sometimes for me to be patient with those that seem so duped.
Yeah.
In the frog soup.
Matt, you make a good point, and I'm not afraid of the F word. Fascism is a fair way to characterize what we're seeing here. Thank you for your call today. And John, as we wrap up here, how many corporations have now backed away from Alec or decided not to continue funding the American Legislative Exchange Council as a result of the activist work at the Center for Media and Democracy?
Well, let's see. I'm not sure what the number's up to today, but there's a real stampede by corporations away from Alec. And it's not just corporations. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had provided Alec with a $376,000 grant. They said that they have now backed away. I would encourage people to go to PR Watch, like in public relations, prwatch.org, and you can probably see corporations walking out of the room on a daily basis now, because especially in the wake of the Stand Your Ground controversy, corporations like Coca-Cola, Kraft Foods, McDonald's, PepsiCo, they don't really want to be associated with racist shootings.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you for joining us. I appreciate your activism, and you remain very well informed there at the epicenter of the conflict, Madison, Wisconsin.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's an honor, as usual, to be on your show, and thanks for thinking of me as a guest.
All right. Very good. That is John Stauber. And again, visit the website of the Center for Media and Democracy, prwatch.org. We're going to take a quick break and return with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen's Green News Report. I have a brief obituary about the Ponce de Leon of American rock and roll. And then Scott Crow is going to join us in a few minutes. He is an anarchist and the author of a book called Black Flags and Windmills. That's straight ahead here on the broadcast, The Brad Friedman Show on KPFK.
KPFK presents An Evening with Van Jones, civil rights and environmental activist and former Obama White House Green Jobs advisor. Van Jones will be signing copies of his new book, Rebuild the Dream, Thursday, April 26th at 6 p.m. at the Pasadena All Saints Church, 132 North Euclid Avenue in Pasadena. Proceeds benefit KPFK Radio 90.7 FM. More details at kpfk.org or contact the front desk at 818-985-2711.
We can't afford a situation where speculators artificially manipulate markets.
Obama calls for a crackdown on oil speculation and big oil profits. Cue right-wing freakout in 3, 2.
The electric car is not about saving the planet. The electric car is not about cleaner energy. The electric car is not about cleaner air. The electric car is about taking away choices from the American people about what they want to drive. The electric car is about bigger government.
Taxpayers save lives in the latest tornado outbreaks. New rules for frackers. Plus, good news for millions who depend on water from the Himalayas.
Millions depend on water from the Himalayas?
Yes.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Yeah, well, how about you, sir? How about all the speculation you're doing in this defunct, nothing there business called green energy?
Well, meow, Rush Limbaugh. This is your Green News Report. Is it my imagination there, or was Rush Limbaugh having a freak out today in response to the president's call for cracking down on oil speculators?
Yes, he was spinning even more wildly than usual. And of course, we should point out the clean energy job sector is the fastest growing sector in the American economy.
Despite what Rush says, he also said this.
They're the people making this political. I don't make anything political.
So you see, Rush doesn't make things political. Where would you ever get that idea?
It's crazy.
Yeah, it is. So what do you have in non-crazy Rush news today?
Well, the latest tornado outbreak over the weekend killed 6 people in Oklahoma, with over 100 reported tornadoes across the Midwest in a 24-hour period. The death toll could have been much higher if it hadn't been for you, the taxpayer.
We know that the tornado's on its way. We hear that it's about 10 or 15 minutes away.
New satellite and weather monitoring equipment paid for by your tax dollars enabled the National Weather Service to issue the most precise advance warnings yet. 48 hours in advance of this latest outbreak, state and local officials credited these warnings with helping residents prepare in advance for the deadly storms that marched across the Midwest.
Oh, you socialists and your life-saving things.
Cracking down on Wall Street oil market manipulators. Energy industry analysts and regulators say Wall Street speculators are partly responsible for skyrocketing gas prices. And on Tuesday, President Obama outlined a new proposal to crack down on those speculators that are harming average consumers and threatening economic recovery.
We can't afford a situation where speculators artificially manipulate markets by buying up oil, creating the perception of a shortage, and driving prices higher, only to flip the oil for a quick profit. We can't afford a situation where some speculators can reap millions while millions of American families get the short end of the stick.
The president is using his executive branch authority to tighten enforcement, but also he's asking Congress to close regulatory loopholes, require speculators to use more of their own money, establish caps on oil futures, immediately increase funding for more regulators with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, and dramatically increase fines and penalties. But in an election year, it is questionable whether the Republican-controlled Congress will act on the president's proposal.
Questionable is an understatement. Are there things that he can do that does not require the Congress?
Yes, he does have some tools within his executive branch authority to do that, but the rest will require congressional action.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Predictably, the right-wing media machine is already freaking out. Immediately after the president's speech in the White House Rose Garden on Tuesday, Rush Limbaugh was also wildly speculating.
But it just makes me wonder if Obama won't go just Hugo Chavez on big oil after he gets reelected, just nationalize him. Why not? That's what he told what's-his-face.
Yes, that's what he's going to do. He's going to go Hugo Chavez on big oil.
And GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney, in a statement, criticized the proposal.
You don't say.
Yes, as a gimmick that burdens oil producers.
Those poor oil producers, only the most profitable corporations in the history of mankind.
New rules for fracking. On Tuesday, the Environmental Protection Agency issued new rules, the first ever, to reduce emissions at well sites for the controversial drilling technique of hydraulic fracturing, known as fracking for short. The EPA's new rules are backed by a new study from the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science that found that fracking releases much more methane into the atmosphere than previously thought, increasing the fumes breathed by people who live nearby and increasing regional smog and air pollution.
And doesn't it also increase earthquakes?
Yep, that too, as we reported last week. Finally, good news. Glaciers in the Himalayas are one of the few glacier groups that appear to be growing, gaining ice, rather than losing it like the rest of the glaciers on the planet. That's according to a new study using new data from state-of-the-art satellites. The researchers say their study does not overturn global warming, as some denier groups have claimed, but they do say it's excellent news for the 1 billion people in the volatile region whose sole source of fresh water is from Himalayan glacier melt.
There you go. More ice somewhere. There's no global warming. For more on that story and all of the others we covered today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, you can download our reports anytime via iTunes, listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio, and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Brad and Desi will be back here for the broadcast at the regular time next Wednesday, 3 to 4 p.m. here on KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, 99.5 FM Ridgecrest and China Lake, and on the web at kpfk.org and the radioornot.com network. Let me throw one more at you. You can email me, Peter, at peterbcollins.com. And now you know my name. I'm sitting in for Brad today. And we'll talk with our guest Scott Crowe in just a moment. But the Ponce de Leon of American pop music finally passed away today at the age of 82. Dick Clark, the longtime host of American Bandstand, it came out of Philadelphia in the late 1950s.
We're going hopping today, where things are popping. The Philadelphia way, we're gonna drop it. On all the music they play on the bandstand. We're going swinging, we're gonna swing in the crowd, and we'll be clinging. And floating high as a cloud, the phones are ringing. My mom and dad are so proud, I'm on bandstand. And I'll jump and hit, I may even show my handstand.
And Dick Clark was known for his youthful looks, even as he advanced in years. And I want to tell you briefly about two encounters I had with Dick Clark. In 1969, he was still the host of American Bandstand when Jim Morrison of The Doors got a lot of negative publicity for an alleged incident. It's never been proven that he exposed his private parts on stage at a concert in Miami. But it produced a whole backlash of righteous people, and Dick Clark got on that bandwagon. And in my hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio, the very first interview I did as a Cub reporter was with Dick Clark. He had come to town for the Teens for Decency rally, which had been put together by a local kid just a couple of years older than me. And I wrangled an interview backstage with Dick Clark. And I was really proud of myself because I was nervous and never done this before, but I thought what he was doing was hypocritical and amounted to censorship. And so I told him that. And he was floored that, you know, a teenager would approach an icon like Dick Clark and ask him a question that was loaded that way. So fast forward to the early 1990s. I had a daily radio talk show here in San Francisco, and Dick Clark was out promoting a book about rock and roll of the 50s and 60s, and he came on the show, and I asked him if he remembered the Teens for Decency rally or even that I had interviewed him there. And at that point, despite his youth and vitality, he had a case of amnesia and didn't want to talk about it. But he was a very interesting character. I do give him credit for bringing African-American artists to a white audience through the American Bandstand show. And I also cringed over the last couple of years because after his very serious stroke that impaired his speech, he continued to appear on the New Year's Eve show. They brought in Ryan Seacrest as his anchor host, but Dick would be there. And the first time they did it, I said, okay, you know, he's showing that he's not quitting. But the last couple of years, I just found it to be in poor taste to see him struggling so hard to just do basic things with his speech. Dick Clark passed away today of a heart attack at the age of 82. Joining me now is Scott Crow. He hails from Austin, Texas. He is a self-described anarchist, and he published a book last year that I found quite interesting called Black Flags and Windmills, subtitled Hope, Anarchy, and the Common Ground Collective. Scott Crow, welcome to KPFK.
Hey, Peter. It's great to be on with you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. And let's just start off for listeners who most people have never heard of me, and I assume that a lot of them have never heard of you. So describe your own definition of what it means to be an anarchist.
Well, basically, it means self-determination of individuals and communities to decide their own futures, that we don't need to vote for people to help tell us what to do in our communities, and we don't need to rely on corporations to tell us what to do in our communities, and that basically we take action to do things cooperatively for our own collective future in a sustainable world.
Mm-hmm. And your work, to my knowledge, has never broken the law. I'm not aware that you have ever advocated violence, but you were subject to the full Patriot Act treatment a few years ago, as they basically treated you like a terrorism suspect.
Yes. And you know that comes about because there's a lot of money to be made in the quote unquote surveillance industry, with the draconian laws that came in pre Patriot Act, but definitely enforced in the omnibus bill called the Patriot Act. And you know the war on terror, which in my opinion is an absolute farce. You've got to have some terrorists, and there just hasn't been any cases in this, you know, in this country. There's been a handful, maybe four or five. People initiated things on their own, but so what what the government has started to do was to look at civil activists. You know, the same actions I've been doing for 20 years all of a sudden became terrorism in hand, to stop corporations from making money, to stop governments from running roughshod over people.
And since that's done up polemics,
but I would say that, you know, it's not going to make me stop what I'm doing, or that I don't think our movements are going to stop doing what we're doing, because we need that counterbalance to power in government.
And Scott, we've seen under President Obama a ratcheting up. You know, I was deeply offended by the Patriot Act and by the wiretapping that occurred under Bush, by extraordinary rendition for the purpose of torturing so-called terrorism suspects, and there's a long list that goes on. But in the 3 years since Obama has taken office, he has cemented some of the extensions of police powers and executive authority that started under Bush. And if we just look at the last 4 months, the NDAA, the defense bill that includes the Homeland Battlefield bill, that says that anybody can be accused of terrorism or related offenses, can be taken into custody, locked up in a military base, held indefinitely without charge or trial. That's one. Then we have the new protest bill that actually passed the House of Representatives a year ago, and where it was in the meantime, I still don't know, but it surfaced in the Senate and was passed with very little debate. And now, if you go to a political convention this summer, Democrat or Republican, and you are in an area that has been designated restricted, you could be arrested and charged with a felony. And yeah, these incursions on public assembly, on free speech rights, you know, these have been ramped up by the Occupy movement and the concern of authorities about them. But as I mentioned, the bill about protesting actually passed out of the House of Representatives more than a year ago before anybody even knew about Occupy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's been the wet dream for conservatives and corporate interests for a long time to pass these bills. A lot of bills started locally, you know, like the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, you know, that passed in 2005, mm-hmm. 2006. You know, I mean, that bill had been working. Texas, where I live, is one of the first places that bill ever came into existence, and that was in the late 80s. So it's just been, they've just been ratcheting these things up. And again, I can't say enough that it's about money. Because corporations are making money on this, and government agencies, as they started to wind down the war on drugs, they've ramped up the war on terror. You know, $75 billion from 2001 to 2008 in spending on it. 4,000 agencies who have been either reassigned or assigned to the war on terror. You know, 854,000 new jobs. There's your job package for Obama and Bush right there.
Yeah,
that's the biggest growth sector right there. They say it's green jobs, but it's not. It's the surveillance industry, and it's a corporate. You know, it's a corporate and government revolving door where people go in and out of the private sector and the public sector.
And Scott, I'm glad you mentioned the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, because that's a real doozy that takes offenses like what do you call it when you damage property? That kind of a violation or
vandalism,
that can then become a crime with a minimum mandatory sentence because it was carried out at a lab facility or a factory farm or some other food facility, and it really doesn't make any rational sense. And I want to point out, since I'm on in Los Angeles today, that Congresswoman Maxine Waters voted for that law. And about a year later, I was interviewing her, and I said, Maxine, why? Why did you vote for that? And I was stunned, because you know what she said? She said, I got that one wrong, and I really feel bad about it. And you know what? I've never heard a member of Congress admit that they voted the wrong way or that they had any feelings about it afterward.
Right. Well, maybe at some point we can unwind this. And I think it's important for shows like yours to talk about this, you know. In my case, you know, they investigated me for almost a decade, and they didn't get me for littering. I was investigated in 9 states and 13 field offices. They spent at least $500,000 and lots of resources to do it, and nothing happened, you know. And that's a big waste of taxpayer money. It's a waste of resources when they could actually really be stopping crime. You know, it's a travesty for political discourse in this country.
It certainly is. We're talking with Scott Crowe from Austin, Texas. We're here on KPFK this afternoon on the Bradcast. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Brad Friedman. And you can call in right now on the KPFA line at 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And we think Roger is still on the line. He's been holding for a bit. Roger, welcome to KPFK. Roger's in Culver City. Did he survive? Roger, going once. All right, I think Roger either left the room or he's in some form of rapture. Scott, I want to turn to the work that you did in New Orleans that you write about in your book, Black Flags and Windmills. And if you could sum it up briefly, you went to New Orleans to try to rescue the friend of a friend. And when you saw the conditions there, you actually went back to Austin and regrouped and brought loads of gear back to New Orleans, where you helped set up the Common Ground Collective. Tell that story to our listeners, would you?
Yeah, basically the Common Ground Collective was the largest anarchist-inspired organization in modern U.S. history. And I don't say that with bravado. It really was. It was an organization that was set up to provide relief and rebuilding, but without government interference. where we would come in with to the communities, and we would ask the communities what they wanted and what they needed to support themselves to build their own self-determination for their community. And so instead of like a Red Cross where it's one size fits all, we asked each community, what do you need? What can we do to support you? And each community had different answers. Some were like, we need some basic medical care. Other people said, we need food services right now. Other people were like, we need to build long-term food security. We need job training. And so between relief and rebuilding, you know, the Common Ground Collective grew, you know, and we started with 3 people and $50. And over the next 3.5 years, we had 27,000 volunteers come through. People just like you and people like your listeners who said, I'm going to do something about this because we see the government is never going to do something about this. And so, and that, in a nutshell, that is the story of the Common Ground Collective. All of us taking action in mutual aid together to make a better world for people who didn't even know, because it's the right thing to do.
And Scott, you had to contend with the authorities who are out of control, with the law enforcement crackdown as they attempted to impose draconian curfews in parts of New Orleans. And I wanted to get your thoughts because on April 4th, a court in Louisiana finally sentenced 5 former New Orleans police officers, and some of them are going to be in prison for the rest of their lives. The sentences range from 38 to 65 years. And I don't have it in front of me, but the judge in the case said that he saw so much perjury in the courtroom that if he had fined people for each time they told a lie, he compared it, he said it'd be like giving away speeding tickets at the Indy 500. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about the outlaws who wore police uniforms in the immediate aftermath of the hurricane and the floods that followed, and if you think justice has actually been served.
Well, I mean, the latter question is justice been served? It's like, no, justice has not been served. Justice has been served in this case, and it should have, and it should have happened a long time ago, but it only scratched the surface of all the things that happened. You know, I'm going to broaden this out for a minute. The larger police forces in this country are out of control generally, and that there are laws that back up things that should not be happening. But what happened in New Orleans is it became an extreme situation before the storm and even more extreme after the storm. And basically, they acted with impunity against the civil population, which happens, you know, daily, but with much more extreme measures. And that the case, you know, the Danziger Bridge case, it's just one of so many that happened after the storm, but at least some justice is gonna be served. And you know, I don't. You know, like, listen, my radical politics tell me that we need to abolish the prison system. It's a longer conversation, but if we're gonna have prisons, I think that those men should be in there as much as anybody else. And I think that there are many more cases like this that I hope come to the surface. You know, it took the feds to actually come into New Orleans to bring other civil rights cases against people for killing people, for lying, for perjuring. But it's so common in so many cases. I can attest to my own FBI documents, the lies that are told in those documents. I would challenge them in open court about it if charges were ever brought against me. But I think it's become part of the system.
Well,
in a fanatical way.
Well, I hear you, Scott. Number one, I agree that we have police departments out of control. Just across the bay from me in Oakland, we saw them attack protesters and create violent incidents around Occupy protests. And people, you know, who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan, who were there to protest and who were trying to leave a scene where there was a police dragnet, were attacked by armed police officers. And there has been no discipline to date for those events. There's been a lot of publicity about the pepper spraying at the University of California at Davis, which I deplore, but the misdeeds by the Oakland Police Department are largely unaddressed. And I just also agree that the whole system of incarceration is riddled with problems. We referred earlier to the PBS Frontline program that was broadcast last night that really shows that a lot of forensic evidence that is introduced at trials and used to convict people is not nearly as reliable as the so-called experts proclaim. And they showed the case of the gentleman, I think his name is Mayfield, from Portland, Oregon, whose fingerprint was confused with a person alleged to be part of the bombing in Madrid, Spain. And it took quite a while for him to clear his name. And all along the way, there were these so-called experts just saying that it was all 100% reliable. And so we know that America has a rich history of wrongful convictions, and DNA testing has helped us understand the dimensions of that. Scott, before we run out of time, I wanted to just briefly reference some of the points you make in your book about your description of anarchism. And I think it might inform people about your view of the term and what it means, and not what corporate media often defines it as. You talk about autonomy, about mutual aid, about direct action, and what I think is important, horizontality, a horizontal approach, or the decentralization and sharing of power, so that no one person or group can dominate decisions. And in a corporate-dominated society like America today, you make a lot of important points, not only addressing what the problems are, but what reasonable community-based solutions can reflect.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. I think, I mean, it's because it's going to take all of us to do this, and we can't keep voting our lives away. We can't keep waiting on putting pressure on corporations to make the change. We have to choose these paths that are in the middle, that we have to build the road as we're walking. And it's going to take all of us to do it, but we have to recognize that we have the power to do it. And we don't want to, it's not against taking over the government. It's building our power from below and building our community the way we see them, not the way corporations see them or governments see them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, I want to thank you.
I know that we can do it.
Yeah, I want to thank you for your work. I think that you're a powerful voice, and I'm glad some people heard you today. I want to invite them to pick up your book, Black Flags and Windmills. It's Scott Crowe. He uses lowercase, no caps in his name. And, Scott, where is the best place for people to find your book?
Any local bookstore that you live near, give them the business first. If not, you can buy it online.
And now, Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, joins us with his reaction to the new film called Bully.
Another polemic documentary has opened. The film is called Bully, and it's already generated a feud. The opposing parties are those incensed by suicides of youngsters bullied into taking their lives, and another incensed faction which believes some victims followed in Bully are being harassed because they're homosexual. The latter group's conclusion is that director Lee Hirsch's blunt but not excessive film promotes a gay lifestyle. To think that it's more important that people, whatever they are, shouldn't hear about homosexuality than being bullied and subsequently killing themselves for the ridicule seems absurd to me, but this is about the film, not what people on the latter side of this issue see as truth. Bully isn't only about gay young people, it's about kids in public school who are ridiculed for being different. A different-looking face, skin color, a mental disorder, lack of sociability. They're traits that trigger bullies. The movie says that bullying is quite problematic. Who can stop it? Teachers, administrators, parents, police, the clergy? The answer to that is almost as contentious as bullying itself. If one is bullied in a public school and his or her parents can't afford to send the child to private school to hopefully avoid peer harassment, options for a positive resolution shrink even more. Bullying is not new. However, a spate of teens bullied to suicide, as media have reported in recent years, has caused many, especially parents of the deceased, to coalesce into an effort to stop the abuse. Public school students in Georgia, Iowa, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and Texas are followed in their daily routine during the 2009-10 school year, in the classroom, on the playground, on the bus, in the street. Some of the street and bus talk includes coarse language familiar to almost anyone and just as common as bullying. Due to a few F-bombs, the filmmaker and the releasing firm, the Weinstein Company, received notice early that the documentary would be rated R by the MPAA. Director Hirsch felt the film couldn't reach younger audiences with an R. Bully has since been rated PG-13 after Hirsch and the Weinstein Group agreed to bleep some offensive language. The picture's most moving moments come when the parents profess their love for their dead children and how much they're missed. Tyler Long, who went to the Murray County, Georgia school system, and Ty Smalley, a student in Perkins, Oklahoma public schools, were both victims of bullying. The boys killed themselves after enough got to be more than enough. Tyler was 17, Ty only 11. The film focuses on their families, with vintage clips showing the boys in daily life. Most attention is paid to Alex Libby, a public school student of Sioux City, Iowa. Fortunately, Alex didn't take his life, but since he's known as Fish Face at school, it's easy to imagine the ridicule that's been part of his life. Hirsch has filmed some of it. Bully doesn't have much of an arc to it. The video is a silent eye on the families, mostly, with brief conversations among the kids, their parents, and between parents and school administrators, as well as board members. Near the finish, it's clear the film is first meant for young people, themselves, not necessarily concerned adults. According to the movie, when someone is about to be bullied, pressure from larger numbers of non-aggressive students that persuades the perpetrators to stop their cruel game is the most expeditious way to undermine it. The finale shows a rally held in October 2010 on the Oklahoma State Capitol grounds in Oklahoma City. The event's intent was to recruit supporters for the Stand for the Silent group now involved with undercutting bullies. Ty Smalley's dad, Kirk, is speaking to the crowd about his son and the importance of working against those who bully. Focus on the Family, a Christian organization that also opposes the PG-13 rating, says Bully encroaches on its members' freedom of religion. The faction believes that gayness is a sin and that the group's faith demands that children must know about what it claims is the sinful nature of homosexuality. Kelby, an Oklahoma teen and uncloseted lesbian, flashes a winning personality in the film. She and Alex show more than enough charisma for doing feature films, not just one about their being bullied. On another cultural note, each Canadian provincial government rates films for its residents, not Ottawa. All Canadian provinces have given Bully a PG rating. On first reading that, I wondered how the teen suicide rate in reaction to being bullied compares between Canada and the United States. I'm Gary Chu, on hold, down in the valley.
Well, Bully for you, Gary, and thank you for that review. And thank you for listening. Drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.